3D printing today, show number 560. 3D printer for a blind person. Boolean edits in Prusa Slicer. The benefit of repeated production.
Welcome back to 3D Printing Today, the podcast about all aspects of 3D printing. Hobby, professional, industrial, it doesn't matter, we cover it all. My name's Andy Cohen, and I'm here with my friend, Mr. Whitney Potter.
How you doing, Andy?
Doing pretty good. So we skipped over the story in our last episode. We should have done this one first. It's about Stratasys and a company called Origin. Now, Stratasys bought out Origin. And can you see what they got? I know they bought... it's resin SLA technology. They got their printers, they got their technology, and the idea that the agreement was they were going to label it Stratasys, and they were going to do certain things to ensure that the origin-based stuff sold, because then Origin would get proceeds from those sales.
Right. So the deal, the acquisition deal, was that it was sort of, I guess, part stock or something, but then part cash. And that cash, there was what's called an earnout payment, which meant that the technology that they were buying from Origin had to basically prove itself in the marketplace over a certain period of time.
Now, unfortunately for Origin, and we've seen this in other situations just like this, and it's in the 3D printing world as well as in other places. When you make an M&A like this, you're going to get acquired, you got to cover everything. You can't just assume... And I'm afraid Origin made some assumptions that Stratasys was going to sell the stuff that Origin would have profited from or gotten some payback from. That assumption was incorrect, and there was nothing in the agreement that ensured Stratasys would do that. As such, Origin didn't get any of the proceeds they were hoping to get.
Well, that's what's being litigated right now, and we don't really know what exactly happened, but essentially Origin is saying that the time period that the earnout payment was to be calculated on was not set properly the way it was, the way they had agreed to it. I guess Stratasys was picking a different earnout period.
Yeah.
And the other thing was that they were supposed to be paid for the use of their IP, whether it ended up, wherever it ended up in the company. And supposedly Stratasys is not, or at least they're contending in their lawsuit that Stratasys is not paying them for their IP that they have adapted into the regular Stratasys product line, whereas there's the sort of the Stratasys Origin, the Origin One, which was a product that Stratasys brought out basically using their technology, and they're only paying them for that, but not for what they're using in other products. So
it looks like it's a $40 million hit, and they're suing Stratasys for, it looks like, that plus the legal costs.
Yeah, it'll be, and who knows, it's being batted back and forth between whether it's going to be in arbitration or whether it's going to be in court, and which district it's going to be heard in. There's been a bunch of stories about this battle going on. So
now, this is just my opinion. This is not any part of this article at all, but it seems to me that when you pull stuff like this, whether it's valid or not, even the perception of it, you're damaging your image.
And sure.
This damages Stratasys, because now if I'm a smaller company and Stratasys is going to come to me and say they want to buy me out and buy my IP, I'm not going to trust them.
Well, and, I'm going to look very carefully and make sure I have some hardcore lawyers going over everything. But I mean, any sort of business dealing in this dollar range should be doing that to begin with.
Yeah, they should.
And, you know, if not everybody plays by the way everybody thinks they should, they end up in court. And this is what's happened.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll hear more about this in the future. But in the way things are going, $40 million is... that's not that big a thing, really.
Well, I think it was for Origin.
Yeah, Origin.
I don't think it is for Stratasys.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway, what's coming up on our show this week?
Let's see. We start out talking about adapting a 3D printer for a blind person to use.
We're going to look at Boolean edits within PrusaSlicer.
And then we talk about the benefit of repeated production.
Let's do it.
So we got a really interesting email the other day from a longtime listener named Judy, who asked interesting questions because she is blind. Hmm. And the question is, how can you make a 3D printer accessible so that a blind person can use it? So it sounds like from her email that she is able to use a regular computer with a pretty good level of functionality using some kind of a screen reader software. But the touch screen on the printer is completely unusable because there's no, or very difficult to use. She actually had a really interesting solution.
Right away, I would tether it.
Yeah. So listen to this. She had a friend actually print her a template that she could hold up against the touch screen.
Oh, that's an idea.
And have a sequence of pushes on the template to launch a print. And then she would put a single G-code file on a flash drive, stick it into the printer, and then use this template to initiate the print.
Hmm.
I thought that was brilliant. But
Another solution would be to tether the computer to the printer,
mm-hmm.
if possible.
Right.
So usually a printer with a touchscreen, you can tether it, and then you use the user interface for controlling the printer in your slicer software.
Yeah.
Assuming that your computer will let you do that. I just got the impression that Judy has that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's making models using OpenSCAD and then slicing with Simplify 3D.
Yeah, Simplify 3D has a really good front user interface for the printers it supports. I just don't know. I'm assuming that you have an audio, like you move it around and it'll tell you where you are audibly. Does the mouse move? Is that how it would work?
I'm not sure how the screen reader software. I mean, I don't know the specifics of Judy's case. I know
some, that can get pretty complex.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I know some people who are blind or visually impaired have some degree of vision that they're able to use with adaptations, and some have no. You know, ability to see at all, and it totally depends on her case. I don't know the specifics of her case, but it sounded like she's retired from the working at the Library of Congress.
Hmm.
So obviously she's able to function at a fairly high level with mm-hmm. technology. My assumption was that if it was on the computer screen, that she would be able to access it somehow.
But you'd like to hear a lot more about how Judy operates the printer and all sorts of other things. I hope, Judy, if you're listening, join our forum and let us know or email us. I'm really curious.
Yeah, really, really, really interesting questions. Another question that she had was to recommend a printer that has a build volume of 300 to 350 millimeters, a little bit bigger than what she's got right now, which is she's got she tells us it's an Anker Make M5 as her current printer, which is a 235 build volume, and she wants a 300 to 350, so just kind of the next size up. But something, I think, hopefully something that would be tetherable.
Hold on a sec. Let's take a look. Okay, we hunted around a little bit. Of course, the Prusa XL is substantially larger than what Judy's asking for.
Well, she's asking for 300 to 350 millimeter XY.
Oh, I think that's not going to meet that. I think it's 330, isn't it?
The Prusa?
Yeah.
I thought it was 360.
Oh, yeah, it's 360.
Yeah, so that's a little bit bigger than
a
what
little
she's
bit
looking for.
Bigger. Two extruder, I think it's around 1300, 12 to 1300 bucks with all the stuff you might need to do with it. Mm-hmm. There's also, what was the other one that we found? The CR10. The CR10, a very inexpensive way to go get the top of the line CR10. You can go 300 by 300 by 400. That's mm-hmm. not an XY, that's an Z.
Yep.
So that's kind of tricky. You can get the CR10 S5, which is 500 by 500 by 500, but that's probably way bigger than you need.
Right.
It's kind of tricky when you've got specifics. You really got to kind of go from the build area that they offer versus the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, based on what you're telling us, a need to be tethered, fully built, your best bet may be the XL. The XL is you're going to get the best support, the best service. Mm-hmm.
The
Prusa XL. At the risk of sounding like I'm a Prusa XL fanboy, I'm not. I try not to be a fanboy, supporting them no matter what, because you know there are limitations and there are issues with the Prusa XL that we have found. However, remembering that it's a hobby machine, and you've got to take out a hex driver no matter what machine you're going to buy.
Right.
The closest to a toaster that you're going to get would be the Bamboo, and the Bamboo is not going to be nearly large enough. Mm-hmm. There's rumors that there's a new Bamboo coming that's going to be substantially larger. Nothing announced yet. Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens.
Yep.
Prusa slicer at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find them. I've now that's my primary slicer software that I use, and not just because I have a Prusa printer. I mm-hmm. also use it for my E3D printer, mm-hmm. and some of my other printers. I can't recall which. And
I use it for the IDEX.
I used it for that IDEX mm-hmm. machine. As I use it more and more, of course, because you're in there, you start to learn other things that it does. And I can't vouch for other slicers because I don't think other slicers do this, at least to this degree. But Prusa Slicer provides some functionality that if you've never used it, you really should try it because it opens up an amazing amount of functionality and tools available to you that go beyond the print quality and the print object itself. Let me give you a specific use case and give you an idea of its strength. Now, what we're talking about here per our title is being able to do Boolean edits within Prusa Slicer. So let me give a use case so this makes more sense. Last Christmas, a lot of the folks that we know, our friends and stuff, remember from last year, I made a multicolored print of a little elf that sits on the shelf kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And some folks asked if I could print a couple more in different colors to make friends with their ones from last year. And I said, sure. But last year, I recalled, after printing a whole bunch of them, I thought, you know, this guy should also be in the tree. But there was no easy way to put a hook on the top of his little elf hat.
Uh-huh.
So this year, when I dropped to the elf hat STL file into Prusa Slicer, I went to the gallery. Now the gallery, it's in a menu item. Let's see, where is that? If you go to Window, which is in the top menus, you'll see Shape Gallery. Well, that's actually not where to go. Although, that comes in very, very handy for things like helper discs,
mm-hmm.
which are very, very useful if you've got a rectangular, large rectangular object that the corners want to pop up, or for some reason you're having trouble sticking onto your bed, little round helper disc that's the same layer height as your first layer. Comes in really handy and one of the best tools you could do to keep your object from popping off the bed.
And once you've got just a simple cylinder, then you can rescale it to whatever dimensions you need for whatever the application, right?
Sure. Yeah. But what I'm going to point you to is something a little different. So let's say I dropped the hat STL, little elf hat in there, and I positioned it the way I wanted to. But now I want to punch a hole through the top of the hat so that you can put a hook in it to hang it as a Christmas ornament in the tree. Well, so I move the mouse pointer onto the hat, onto that object, and I right-click. Well, that's because I'm in the wrong view. You got to be in the object view. It's not cooperating with me. You right-click. And the menu pops up, slide down towards the bottom, and you'll see a bunch of menu items starting with add part, add negative volume, add modifier, add support blocker, add support enforcer. It's interesting. And height range modifier. All of these are really interesting things. And we can explore some of these in other segments. But the one that we want to look at today is the add negative volume. So I wanted to punch a hole through the top of the hat. So I pick cylinder, and you get this ghost image of a generic cylinder with the grabber corners on it. That means it's selected. That little ghost image is selected, and you could deselect it and go to your object and position your object towards it, or you click on it and select it and go to the sizing tool, the scale tool, or the moving tool on the left. And then rotate size and rotate and position the cylinder up so that it now intersects the top of the hat. And then when I slice, it'll Boolean out that little cylinder from the top of the hat, basically punch a hole through the hat. And I could do that in the slicer and not have to go back to do something in the STL in some mesh editor or go back to the original files. I can just do it in the slicer.
Now, can you export the STL after you've done that? So you or save it so that you've preserved this change to it?
In Prusa Slicer, you can save it as a 3MF file, and that will keep everything that you've done for that file for that printer. But can you then port that to somebody else? I don't believe you can. That's the one thing that is different. If you want to make it a permanent fix onto the object that you would then distribute onto, say, Thingiverse, your best bet's to actually do it to the model, the original mesh.
Gotcha.
In some way.
Yeah. Now, you're doing this with a cylinder as your cutting tool. Can you define a cutting tool, or is it just you have just a couple of choices?
You can do, that's a good question. You can do some basics. And this is the same for all of these items, the adds that I mentioned earlier. The basics are a box, cylinder, sphere, or slab. You could do it with text, but you can also do it with an SVG file.
Okay.
And you can also load a file.
But can you load an STL and use that?
Yes.
Okay, sweet.
Or what I've done in the past is I've put objects into my gallery, and then you can just pick it out of the gallery.
Gotcha.
So I've had objects, I remember I, for a music store, I developed a part that they would give away, kind of like a guitar pick, a plastic guitar pick, and I had to put their name on each of these. So I saved the name as an object within the gallery, and then I picked it up and I used an add part for that, and I made it a different color. But you could also use it as a negative volume and then get a kind of an etched,
etched
text.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Very, very, very handy. And it happens within the slicer. And yeah, you can save it all as a 3MF, but porting it to a different machine, that could be tricky.
Yeah. I remember years ago, I was so intrigued with the idea of, you know, when Booleaning first became sort of a thing you could do with 3D models, I was so intrigued with the idea that I made a whole series of Boolean punches that were were basically tools to create like a keyhole hanger to hang something off like a screw head or something. Mm-hmm. Or I had another tool that basically punched a space inside of an object for an LED and a 2032 battery. So the idea that you could add new functionality to some object, you know, the my favorite example was taking a statue of Yoda and punching a hole in his butt that allowed you to
put
in an LED and a battery. Yeah, and you could, and you could make them glow. But you could do that with anything.
But you can take, here's another use case. Let's say you're an artist and you make sculptures, right? Well, get yourself a Sharpie, a thick one, and sign your name, really cool, really nice signature.
Right.
And scan that in. And then you can make a 3D emboss object of that, or actually not emboss, make it the actual 3D object.
Mm-hmm.
Save that in your gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Bring it in and size it properly. And then you can emboss that underneath every part that you make.
Yes. Or
your signature.
Anybody else who makes things can put your signature on it too.
Well, that doesn't go with the part. That stays only on the print.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that you would sign them in the slicer,
right,
so that you're not releasing a
yes. Right.
Well, that's true, but somebody else could make the punch, the cutting tool that is your signature as well.
They'd have to get your signature. That'd be kind of tricky to reverse engineer that. I don't know.
Take me about 10 minutes.
I don't think so. I'm going to test you on that.
Okay.
Now, one thing we don't know is exactly what it's doing, because it's doing it to the tool paths. It's not doing it to the mesh.
Right.
So this is processed after the mesh, after the vertices are looked at, and while it's slicing, similar to the coloring part of this program, which we've talked about before.
Right.
Very different approach from other ways that we've done this.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of architecturally in terms of the system, a choice to do it that way, because in some respects, you're sort of locking people into that platform, right? Because if you spend a lot of time working in that platform, adding value to a part like coloring it or doing you know these 3D you know modifications to it, and that can't be exported to another platform, then you're pretty well locked into this one, right?
And there's value in that, and there is negatives to that.
Sure.
It all depends upon how you want to use it.
Right.
Now let's say you want to sell files that could be printed and you want them to be colored. This is not the path to do it with the color tool.
Right.
The path to do it is to make the different colored parts separate parts and provide the files with the retained positions of the objects, so that you don't sell them as separate files. You sell them as a singular file with separate objects within it, retaining their positions.
Yeah.
Technically, some people don't understand how to do that. That could be kind of tricky.
And some slicers don't understand that necessarily.
Sometimes the slicers don't get it.
Some of them, they're getting better now, but some of them used to default to trying to land everything on the build plate, because that's how you want your part has to be landing on the build plate to be printed. We all know that, right?
Yeah.
But if it's the eyeballs for the top of your teddy bear's head, they don't want to be landing on the build plate. They want to be in the eye sockets.
Right? Yeah, well, as multi-material capabilities proliferate, those requirements will become more prevalent, and people will start knowing how to do it.
Yep.
But for now, this is a good solution. So there's two ways of looking at the 3D printing experience. You know, there's the first time you print an object. I'm not going to say the first time you print. That's not fair. First time you print can be an adventure. For sure, we've all had that adventure.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you've been printing for a year or two, and you've been through that quite a bit. I'm talking about when you're all of a sudden you're looking through 3D Hubs or Thingiverse or Make or whatever one you're looking at through, Thangs or whatever, and you see something that's like, oh, wow, yeah, my partner's been saying they need that, and they look at it and go, yeah, that would solve our problem. Let's make that. and you download the file, edit, put it in your slicer and slice it, that's a new kind of an adventure. That it's like the best analogy I could come up with, and I know it's not a very good one because I hate playing golf, but the best analogy is playing golf. Okay. The first time you go to a brand new golf course, you're like, well, I see how far the hole is, so I know which club to pick by experience. You know, so the better a golfer you are, the more heuristics and strategies you have for a course you've never been to. It's the exact same kind of problem solving you'll be going through for a first time 3D print. And that in and of itself can be fun and adventurous and a hobby. And I've experienced that a lot.
See, what you need is a good caddy, right? Because your caddy be like, I should think the number three iron, sir.
I should think
PLA, sir, with full contact support.
PLA with a 0.3 nozzle opening. Yeah, exactly. At a slow speed.
At a 0.2 mil layers. Yes, I should think so.
I would bet that eventually we will have an AI agent in there giving us advice like that.
I want it to sound just like that. like, oh no, sir, I shouldn't think ABS.
That would be bad.
No, ABS would never do, sir.
Well, anyway, that's not what this segment's about. Okay, this segment's about the opposite kind of experience.
Yes.
Where you've played that golf course every day for a year, and you know every nook and cranny, you know every idiosyncrasy about that golf course. An object that you've had to print for production for multiple production runs.
Okay.
It's a different experience entirely.
Sure.
If you've been printing something, the same thing, over and over and over and over again, it becomes press a button and walk away.
Well, yeah, it's dialed in, but it's dialed in for that.
For part. That object.
With printing with that material on that printer.
Yes.
Right.
Now, I get that experience at least once or twice a month from I get it from a couple of clients, but most of the clients I've had over the years are brand new golf course. Good luck.
Right. Yeah. Always.
But this, every now and then I'll get a client that says, here's my object, or they've come to me and asked me to make the object. That's typically what it is.
Yes.
I help design it for them. And then I produce it for them. And sometimes they're clients where, and these really are my favorite clients because I don't have to do anything. I just push a button.
Right. Literally. Cause you could just leave their file. If you know it's going to be a repeat customer, just leave the file on the card.
Exactly.
You just got to make sure you got the right material in the machine.
Right. It's the least amount of work, but when you've got a client that's like that, you tune it, you find the optimum material, optimum temps, optimum speeds, everything about your settings are tuned because you've been doing it again and again and again. And right now, this last one I did yesterday, I produced over a dozen of these objects effortlessly. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different experience, totally different experience. And if you're out there and you're a hobbyist and you're going, you've never experienced that, find something where it makes sense to do that. Because
find something that you want a lot of.
That you want a lot of them, or you're going to give a lot of them away. Uh-huh. Because really, it is the ideal 3D printing experience. It really is. You just push a button, walk away, come back, and there's a pile of stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty marvelous.
And they're all perfect.
All right.
Wow. It's a great. Yeah. It's a great experience.
Once you get to that point, of course, then you can realize when your printer needs maintenance, when they start coming out and they're not perfect.
Yeah, that's a negative experience. Right. In the extreme.
Like, I need to clean the nozzle.
Yeah. So, I've talked about this before. This is, most of this kind of stuff is on my Race 3D N2. Mm-hmm,
sure.
And it's the old craptastic Ultimaker style kind of XY gantry style, and this is why I tell people, don't buy them anymore. They're obsolete.
Right.
So it's now coming on 10 years of age. I think it's about 7 or 8 years now, maybe older. And It's been used a lot. It's paid for itself at least a dozen times. Mm-hmm. It's still paying for itself again and again and again. But the lube, the way the producers at Race3D did the gantry on this first product of theirs, it was lubed excessively. Mm-hmm. Not usually the lube on your gantry is only within the bearings themselves. You don't lube the ways.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. You lube the bearings. You lube that. You don't dump lube on the rods or the rails.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the optimal way to do it.
Well, having lube sitting out in the environment like that is going to collect dust.
Exactly.
And all kinds of crap.
And that's exactly what happens because Race3D didn't do it the right way. Instead, uh-huh. they lubed the heck out of all of the rods because everything's running on those rods mm-hmm. and those rods yeah. are spinning. So, yeah, it picks up dirt really quickly. I get maybe 3 or 4 production runs, and then I cut in and I notice I'm going out of register. Why am I going out of register? I take my hand, then I grab the carriage, and mm-hmm. I physically move it with
you
the power off.
You can feel it sticking.
I can feel it, you know, resisting. So I have to take a paper towel
uh-huh.
and wipe all the lube off,
uh-huh.
clean it till it's dry.
And shiny.
and I have to put on nitrile gloves uh-huh. because yeah. it's really messy.
Yeah.
And then re-lube it really carefully. Yeah. And then it's perfect again. But that's good. You know, that's a good 15-20 minute
sure.
maintenance job.
But it's good to have a part that you know will print perfectly when the printer is running right.
That's correct.
Because then when something starts messing up with it, you can sort of start eliminating. You're like, well, it's not a problem with the part. It's not a problem with the material because this part usually prints perfectly with this material on this machine. So something's wrong with the machine.
Right.
Whereas if it's the first time you've printed it, it can be really hard to figure out where the problem is.
Yep.
And particularly if you're not that experienced with this stuff and you've got a problem happening with the machine, you know, a hardware problem, and you got no idea what's going on. You just know that you're having problems with your prints.
Right. And so. For a new 3D printing person, that can be stressful.
Yeah, for sure.
And so hopefully you're listening to this podcast and we can help out and join our forum and ask for help on the forum.
There you go.
Oh boy, Whitney, another show written to the hard drive, waiting for encoding, uploading, and commitment on our feed to all of our very supportive listeners. Thank you all out there for your support on Patreon. Thank you for those positive reviews. We really do appreciate those. And hey, you know, we do it for you. Thanks for listening. We do it for fun. We're not really here to become pundits or influencers or make a TV show. That's not what we do. We're here because we love to talk about 3D printing and our hobbies and our projects. And every now and then we turn the mics on and we turn it into a podcast. So I've got a thing of the week this week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a thing of the week, which led us to a secondary thing of the week. This is called the Helping Hands Soldering Electronics Projects. It's basically a Helping Hands project thing where you clip two wires to alligator clips and it holds it in place.
Right,
while you can solder them.
Yep.
What I like about them is they have their own, they're freestanding.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, you've got a lot more flexibility, although they'd have to be fairly light. So wires are probably optimal for this particular thing. But the thing, this thing, which comes to us from a Thingiverse user whose handle is Dan Mann.
Whose name is Dan Mann, with two N's, right?
Where's he from?
It doesn't say.
Oh. Anyway, this is a remix from...
People tell us where you're from. That's the coolest part.
Yeah, it's one of the best things. this is actually a remix from another thing which we will also consider as a thing of the week, which is called the Modular Mounting System Update from a Thingiverse user whose handle is Hey V.
Who is otherwise known as Ryan Huang.
And he
doesn't tell us where he's from either.
Oh, guys. And this is from 5 years back. Now, this is a mounting system for all sorts of objects like a smartphone or a camera. Basically, the mounting objects, the stand, are what's been used in the first thing. But this secondary thing includes a desk clamp, which can come in very handy. I would suggest if you print the desk clamp, print it in HTPLA and anneal it and it won't. It'll work way better. Mm-hmm. If you don't, it will eventually move, bend, and lose its grip or break.
Yep.
So when you make desk clamps, you want it to be as rigid and strong as possible. And in our experience, annealed HTPLA seems to be one of the best materials for that application. Yep. Also, it's relatively inexpensive.
And all of these seem to have adopted basically the GoPro joint.
Yes.
There's sort of an interleaved joint system that GoPro mounts use that these all seem to have, seem to be. I couldn't guarantee that it's compatible, but it's certainly the same configuration. Whether it's actually compatible in the same size or not, I couldn't say. But it would be really cool if it was, because then you could use these products to adapt all kinds of other things, the whole sort of ecosystem of GoPro mount type things. So,
which is very cool.
Yeah.
So let's see the first object, which is the helping hands. That is thing number 694-6848.
And the helping hands that it was mounting system that it was originally remixed from is thing number 219-4278.
Now, the update to that, though, you want to do the update. That's 461-9937. A bunch of great things, and it's one of those links that you want to put a like on so that you can get back to them, because someday you might need it, and these are good ones. These are good ones to try. I've done lots of systems like this that utilize that methodology of joint, and they're very handy. We'll probably have another thing of the week next week using the same approach.
Cool.
If you've got a tip, a question, or a candidate thing of the week, what are you waiting for? Send us an email.
Send it to info@3dprintingtoday.com. That's THREE, followed by the letter D, followed by printingtoday.com.
And I invite everyone listening to our free forum on Google Groups. This is where we get a lot of our discussion, and we generate a lot of the stuff that we talk about on this podcast. And in essence, you become part of the podcast by joining this Google group. It's watched over by me personally. There's no spamming. There's no flame wars. It's not a specific 3D printer technology based. It's as generic as we try to keep this show. So if you want to go there, go to Google. Type in 3D printing tips and tricks. When you get there, if you want to post, because you don't really have to post, you can just read. But if you want to post, go to the right side. You'll see a small button that says join group. Give them an email. And again, I don't recommend using your personal email. I suggest going to Gmail, make a Gmail account just for that purpose. And then you can use that Gmail account for all your interactions with that Google group.
Do you think our show is generic? You just called our show generic.
Generic to 3D printing.
Yeah, okay.
We don't talk about just bamboo.
Okay.
We don't talk about just Prusa. I know there are times when it seems that way, right, when we have a new machine and we focus on it week after week, but eventually it goes into the garage and we get the next one. And that could take 6 months, which is also unlike many of the tubers that do one episode on that.
True. Okay, so we're brand agnostic.
Agnostic, that's the
word.
There
you go. Yeah, all right.
Oh, well. What's coming up next week?
I don't have the next week yet.
Well, you don't? Okay, well, next week we're going to look at fibers on the build plate, and we're going to discuss the limits of FDM. I guess that's it.
Great. Thanks for listening.